how much they depended on God's grace and strength, that we have to rely on God's grace. We have to rely on God's strength, the strength that he provides for us. And I understood that there is one sense in which that meant that I shouldn't be relying on my own good works to save myself. But I always felt like there was something even more practical than that. Not that what I just said isn't practical, but that when it comes to my daily living, trying to do the things that God has asked me to do, that there's got to be some sense in which I rely on God's strength to do a good deed right now in front of me that God has told me to do. And so what I want to share this morning are some things that I think helped me think through some of those concepts. And so the question of this lesson is going to be, are you relying on the strength that God provides and the grace that he gives us to rely on what he, to give us the strength that he wants us to have? And maybe one way to think about this as we get started here is to think about different kinds of strength that the world can provide and then contrast that with how you know if you're relying on God's strength. Think for a moment about some of the different kinds of strength that somebody could have. You could have Samson, for example, who had physical strength. Samson was somebody who, ironically, was spiritually weak. His struggle was lust, and it was very fitting that his eyes were plucked out. Remember when that happened? And it seemed like after he lost his eyes, that's when he started to finally rely on the strength that comes from God, and in his death, he ends up doing a very good deed. I think that was his great moment of faith. But before that, he was somebody that was very impressive, who could lift big gates, and he could snap cords that were around his arms and stuff like this. Very impressive physical strength, but lacking in spiritual strength. You might also think of the rich young ruler. Remember this man that comes to Jesus, and he kneels down before Jesus, very respectful. And he asks Jesus, "Good teacher, what must I do to be saved?" And Jesus goes through some of the Ten Commandments, leaving out the ones about loving God more than anything else. But this guy seemed to really love his neighbor. And, but he was unwilling to let go of all of his wealth and follow Jesus. He had financial strength. What could he do with that financial strength? He could buy new camels, modern day buy a bunch of cars, buy a nice house, whatever. He had financial strength, but no spiritual strength. Or I think about Jeroboam. The first king in the northern kingdom, he's got all of this political strength. You ever been impressed with somebody that has all kind of political strength? They can pass laws and things like this. Well, here's Jeroboam who's got political strength. And the first thing that he does with his political strength is he says, all right, how about this? We make these golden calves in Dan and in Bethel. And that's going to be the first thing that I do with my political strength, but it's not coming from a place of spiritual strength at all. That's not what God told him to do. Or I think about Solomon, who indeed had financial and political strength. But before Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, there was Solomon, who wrote books like Ecclesiastes and Proverbs. And I took a lot of philosophy classes in college, and when we would read from Nietzsche and Plato and Aristotle and all these people, if you started reading Ecclesiastes alongside of it and you didn't know that it was in the Bible, it would feel like a book that belongs in a philosophy class. And so Solomon had a lot of intellectual strength. You've got the Queen of Sheba traveling 1,400 miles on a chariot that probably didn't have very good suspension, like our cars do today. And she's traveling all this distance so that she can learn the wisdom of Solomon. Very great intellectual strength. But at the end of his life, no spiritual strength. Are you impressed with these kinds of strengths that the world has to offer? How would you know if you have spiritual strength? Because the truth is, for a lot of us, we're not going to have these kinds of strengths in this world. I'm never going to have political strength. I'm never going to have much intellectual or financial or physical strength. Those things I don't really have access to, but the strength that we all have access to is the strength that comes from God. So how would you know if you have spiritual strength? I think the answer to that, in short, would be if you're growing in your holiness. The way that you know that your heart is being influenced by God's grace and his strength is when what you want to do and what you ought to do have been married together. I think one of our biggest struggles, one of my biggest struggles, is that I don't always want to do the things that I know I'm supposed to do. The way that I know that I have spiritual strength is when I overcome that. And I do what God has asked me to do. So that's what I want to talk about in this lesson this morning. In 1 Corinthians 15, I want to look at chapter 15, verses 8 through 11. And in this text, you're going to see Paul saying something about how he depended on the strength and the grace that came from God. Now, in the context, Paul has been talking about how Jesus appeared to the different apostles after his resurrection. And he says that last of all, Jesus appeared to him. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 8 through 11. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me, for I am the least of the apostles, unworthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God, I am what I am, and his grace toward me was not in vain. On the contrary, I worked harder than any of them, though it was not I, but the grace of God that is with me. Whether then it was I or they, so we preach, and you believed. All right, you notice here that what Paul does is he's comparing himself to the other apostles, and he says that I worked harder than any of them. Now, I don't think he's diminishing the work that the other apostles did. But who do we know more about today? We know more about Paul today than any of the other apostles. We know that he traveled quite a long distance. He wrote a lot of the New Testament. And so he's saying that he engaged in very extensive work. Well, what would some of that work have entailed? Well, he was involved in preaching and teaching constantly. The mental energy that it would take to prepare a lesson and then be able to deliver it. He was doing this everywhere he went. And while he did this work, he was oftentimes having to support himself. He was having to make tents, probably during the siesta time of the daytime where people would be taking naps and stuff like this. Here he is making tents, and then when he's got opportunity to teach, he's teaching. How well do you think he slept at night? I would imagine that if he wasn't stressed out about how other Christians were doing, he'd be sleeping very well. So he's preaching and teaching, and then he's having to support himself during parts of his ministry. And during all of this work he was doing, everybody just loved him, right? I heard one British theologian say at one point that wherever I go, I'm served tea, because he's British, you know, and wherever Paul went, there were riots. Paul, wherever he went, there was some kind of problem. And I think, by the way, one of the reasons why Luke is writing the book of Acts to a Roman official, Theophilus, most excellent Theophilus, I think is a Roman official title, that what would a Roman want to know about this Christian movement he's heard about and he's believed in to some extent? He would want to know, is Christianity causing problems wherever it goes, or is it the reaction to Christianity? And then you got the book of Acts that in part is answering, look at how people are reacting to Christianity and to the preaching. That's the problem. It's not Christianity itself. But Paul would write this about this persecution that he would endure in Second Corinthians chapter 11, verses 23 to 25. He talks about how he went through countless beatings, often near death. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. 1 night and 1 day I was adrift at sea. All right, I underlined the things that he can number. You notice that? He says that 5 times I was lashed, 3 times beaten with rods, 1 I was stoned, probably that time in Lystra in Acts 14, 3 times he was shipwrecked. Notice all the things that he can count, but what is the first thing he says here? Countless beatings. Paul, you can at least count to 5. How many times were you beaten? So many times. Everywhere he's going, people are just not appreciating him. And in addition to that, he's writing a lot of things. My favorite thing to do is one-on-one meeting with somebody, talking to them about the Bible. 2nd would have to be Zoom. It's not my favorite thing. 3rd would have to be writing letters and email correspondence. I don't like doing that. I'd rather just meet with somebody and see the emotions and see the reactions to what the Bible's saying and things like that. Paul would write letters to people. Do you like doing that? Or he would also be involved in training people. I went through a 2-year training program with Barry Kircheville when I was in Nashville, and he could attest that I was a lot of work. And so if you go through a training program, if you're training somebody, that involves a lot of work to what you're already trying to do. So when Paul says that I worked harder than any of the other apostles, look at all this work that he did. But did you notice in 1 Corinthians 15 verse 10, back in our text that we started with here, that Paul is very quick to say that it wasn't I doing all of this, it was the grace of God that was within me. This means that as Paul would go from city to city preaching the gospel, that one of the things that was consciously on his mind was, I'm going to go to Lystra right now. I just got stoned in Lystra. I'm going to go to this other place. And I guess what he kept thinking to himself was, God has been good to me. 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 And somehow, some way, that gave him the strength to keep doing all of this work that he was doing. Now, you notice that in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 10, that he says that God's grace was not in vain. I did not receive God's grace in vain. Did you know that you could receive God's grace in vain? What does it mean? What does vanity mean? For something to be vain, it means it's useless, it's meaningless. It's kind of like what Ecclesiastes talks about. That it's of no good use or purpose. How do you know if you've received the grace of God in vain? If you're not working tirelessly for the Lord. That's what Paul's point is here. That I'm working harder than the other apostles. I'm doing all of this work. I'm enduring the persecution. And all of that is evidence that I didn't receive God's grace in vain. Think about this in your life. If you're not working for the Lord, could it mean that you haven't fully digested what God's grace is supposed to look like in your life and what it's supposed to do in your life? That we're not relying on it like we ought to. And this isn't the only place that Paul would talk about this concept. He would say the same thing in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1. He tells Timothy, "You then, my child, be strengthened by the grace that is in Christ Jesus." In the context, he goes on to talk to Timothy about how he's got to be working like a soldier and like an athlete and like a farmer. All of those things take strenuous, tireless effort. And Paul's telling Timothy, in the midst of all of this stuff that you're doing, be strengthened by God's grace. This is not only Timothy, make sure that, you know, you're not doing your good deeds to try to save yourself. Jesus has already done that. This is in the good deeds that you're trying to do for God. You're relying on God's grace and strength. So think about this for you. When you're engaged in good deeds for the Lord, is one of the things that you consciously think of is that God's been good to me and this is why I'm going to do this. Perish the thought that we would ever think in terms of, well, this is going to help my reputation and this is going to cause me to get respected in different kinds of ways and all this kind of stuff. That was not what was on Paul's mind. So what I want to do, the second thing I want to do in this lesson is think about some concrete examples in everyday living on how God's grace would give us strength to do the things that he's asked us to do. By the way, I'm going to show you just 5 quick examples of this. But what we're going to see is, in every one of these examples, is some kind of instruction for us. But wrapped up in this instruction, we're going to see something to do with God's grace towards us that fuels us to do the thing he's asked us to do. So we'll see this as we go through this. But the first example I want to look at is Hebrews chapter 12, verse 3. Hebrews 12, 3 says this: "Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted." What's the instruction in this passage? Don't grow weary or faint-hearted. Anybody been tempted to grow weary or faint-hearted in the last year? Well, we've had a lot of stuff happen, right, in this country. There's been some Christians that have fallen away during this last year and a half or whatever. There's been a lot of things that have been confusing on the news and there's all kinds of things that we're trying to wrap our minds around and try to understand. And in the midst of this, there's so much wickedness going on around us. And then some of this gets very personal where we're struggling in our zeal for the Lord. The audience of Hebrews, why were they tempted to grow weary or faint-hearted? There's one little section in Hebrews where we learn about the audience, and it's that little section in chapter 10, verses 32 to 35. And we know that the audience has had their property seized, some of them, that some of them are in prison, that they're suffering because they're Christians. And then the writer of Hebrews says, consider him who endured from sinners hostility so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. All right, so imagine for a moment that you're sitting across the table from somebody who's tempted to grow weary and faint-hearted. What's the advice you're going to give them? Just look at the bright side. You notice that that's not what the writer... That's okay to say that sometimes. Sometimes people just need to learn how to do that. But you notice what the writer of Hebrews says? He's not saying just look at the bright side. No, no, no. He's saying you realize that your Savior went through all kinds of difficulties. He was misunderstood by people. You ever been misunderstood by people? Does that make you feel frustrated? Jesus didn't have much for finances. He did things for people and they weren't always thankful for it. Remember the story of the 10 lepers and only one of them was thankful? Have you ever done a good deed for somebody and they didn't show a lot of gratitude and you're like, well, I don't know if I should keep doing this. Consider what Jesus went through. You notice the idea though, that when you're tempted to grow weary or faint-hearted, how do I rely on the strength that comes from God? I meditate on the fact that He knows what it's like to go through that and He endured it for me. And so therefore, I can endure it for Him. So if you're tempted to grow weary or faint-hearted, when was the last time that you had conscious thought about how much Jesus suffered for you? Not just on the cross, but during His whole ministry. Should that give us some strength? Notice another example. Luke chapter 9, verse 23. And He said to all, if anyone would come after Me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow Me. What's the instruction in this passage? The instruction in this passage is to take up the cross, which is not just a symbol of shame. It was actually the thing you were killed on. So when He's telling people to take up your cross, to just take it up, that means that you're going to have to be okay with people looking at you in a shameful kind of way. That you're okay with people making fun of you. That you're okay with people maligning you for being a Christian. So there's the outward aspect of taking up the cross, how society views me. You got to be okay with that. But then there's the inward aspect of taking up the cross. Galatians, for example, would talk about putting to death the deeds of the flesh. And it would talk about being crucified with Christ, talking about the fleshly passions that we have. So there's the external, I'm willing to be put up with the shame. And then there's the internal, where I'm willing to put away certain desires that the world may tell me to just be true to yourself. And then the Bible says, no, 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 take up the cross. Put your desires to death if they're sinful. So what's my motivation for anybody ever struggled with just wanting to do that all the time? Anybody ever struggled with wanting to like hide the fact that you're a Christian because of how people... So what does it mean to rely on God's strength? It means to know that in this text, Jesus says, if anyone would come after Me, you're following Him. That's the last thing that He says there. Follow Me. You're coming after Him. He's the one that first went and did all of these things. What does it mean to rely on God's strength when it comes to taking up the cross? To know that He did it first for you. And if I consider that and meditate on it, it's going to give me the strength to do it for Him. Notice, you see these instructions. There's an instruction, and then there's something to do with God's grace that helps us fulfill the instruction. Notice this third example for husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her in Ephesians 5:25. All right. What does it mean for a husband to love his wife? It means that he's willing to sacrifice for her. That he's willing to be uncomfortable to make her comfortable. It means that he's thinking about her first in the decisions that he makes. Which is going to require a lot of self-discipline and a lot of selflessness. And for a husband that's struggling with this, and somebody was to tell him, hey, rely on God's strength so that you can be a better husband. Well, how do I do that? What do I have to think about? Do you see what it is in this passage? Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her. What's going to make a husband be a better husband? Is when he grows in his appreciation for how much Jesus has first loved him. And if he doesn't think that he needs Jesus' love very much, then he's not going to be a very sacrificial person. Notice a fourth example. Ephesians 4:32. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. What's the instruction here? To forgive. Anybody ever struggled to be a forgiving person? You don't know what they did to me. You don't know how bad it was. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of really ugly things in this world. But the person who struggles to be forgiving is the same person who fails to realize how much they needed God's forgiveness. And if they can think more and more about how much I have offended God, then it's going to allow me to understand how much I needed His forgiveness, and then in turn allow me to give forgiveness to other people more and more. We forgive as God forgave us. Some people will say, well, we should forgive because you're going to feel blessed and relieved if you forgive others. Is that true? That's true. But is that really the primary motivation for forgiving somebody? What if I do forgive somebody and I don't feel relief right away? And I'm still trying to work through not holding it against the person anymore and stuff like this. Well, then I guess that I shouldn't have forgiven the person. Or how about my motivation becomes, God did this for me first. And that's the reason that I'm doing this. Notice the last example. Luke chapter 19, verse 10. This is after Zacchaeus, the wee little man, climbs up the tree. Luke chapter 19, verse 10. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. Pretty simple statement. Jesus would say in the Gospel of John that as I was sent into the world, so are you sent into the world. So when you look at what Jesus did, He's the one that we're supposed to imitate. And so He says here that He came to seek and save the lost. Notice that He did not come to tell everybody about the keto diet plan. He didn't come to tell everybody what kind of political views you should have. He didn't come to heal everybody of every physical ailment that they had. He came to seek and save the lost. And then He turns around and says, as I was sent into the world, so are you. You know how hard evangelism can be? So when I left San Diego, 2 years ago, there's a lot of non-Christians in San Diego. There's a lot of atheists in Atlanta. And I study with a lot of atheists. That's one of the things that I came from a secular background, a family that didn't believe in the Bible, didn't really know if God was real, all this kind of stuff. And, there's a lot of atheists here. I study with them every Monday night. You know how hard it is to understand where they're coming from? Like to actually read the literature that they read and then find the flaws with that stuff and then try to make that a bridge to helping them know about the Lord? You know how hard it is to listen to all of those different kinds of things and try to reason and be patient in how stubborn they can be at times? It's hard work to teach the lost. When was the last time that you were engaged in somehow influencing the lost and you thought to yourself, you know what, I got to keep this up because this is why Jesus came. He came to seek and save the lost, and I was one of the ones who was lost, and so I got to keep doing this for Him. There's a lot of different passages in the Bible that say something like, do this, and there's some connection to how good God has been to you first. Everything God has told us to do, He has done it for us first. And if I know that, that's going to give me the strength to do it. But have you ever thought about the impossible commands that Jesus gives in the Gospels? If you just look at the Gospel of Mark, for example. There are so many commands that Jesus gives that are impossible for the people to obey. Let me give you some examples. He tells a guy with leprosy, be clean. Can you imagine being the leper? You're like, okay, I'll try really hard. I'll be clean. Or there's another time where He tells a paralyzed man, rise, take up your bed and go home. Can you imagine the guy like on the stretcher? He's like, okay, He just told me to rise, take up. I'm trying really hard. How can I do that? Or the guy with the withered hand. It was his right hand in the Gospel of Luke. By the way, most people are right-handed. And it's an agricultural society. You can't farm. You need a lot of help right now because of this withered hand that you have. Jesus tells a man with a withered hand, stretch out your hand. Can you imagine being that dude? You're like, how do I do that? Or what about this dead girl? This is maybe the best one. He tells a dead girl, hey, little girl, I say to you, arise. She's dead. Or He tells the apostles when they're going to feed the 5,000 people, you give them something to eat. We don't have the money. We don't have the food. We're in this deserted place. There's not marketplaces super close. So what are we going to do right now? Do you notice that every single one of these commandments are insulting?
Unless Jesus can give you the strength to do it, which he does in every one of these stories. Have you ever looked at something that God has commanded you to do and thought to yourself, I can't do that? You realize that everything he's commanded us to do, everything, he will provide the strength for us to do it by his grace. My oldest son is 6. Abigail, she's almost 4. Hannah is almost 20 months. And then my wife is pregnant. She's due in like 3 weeks. So if I just talk to my son Asher, my 6-year-old, and I said, hey Asher, I need you to take me to the airport. I just went to Seattle a couple weeks ago for a gospel meeting. If I would have told Asher, hey, take me to the airport. And he says, where are the keys? I don't even know how to start the car. And I go, Asher, what's wrong with you? I'm going to take away all of your dinosaurs. No more playing with the dinosaurs because you don't know how to take me to the airport. What kind of dad would do that? Scolding a kid for something that the kid could never even do, and I don't even have the strength to help Asher know how to do that right now because of his age and his abilities. Do you think God is like that? You think God would give us a bunch of commands in the Bible, and he's going, na-na-na-na-na, you can't really do it, now I can slap you across the face? That's not what he's like. Everything he's told us to do, he'll give us the strength to do it, but we've got to think about what he's done for us first. So I want to end this lesson by just thinking about two things briefly. How do we grow in spiritual strength? How do we grow to understand that he can strengthen us and that he will strengthen us to do whatever he's asked us to do? The first thing briefly is to seek humility. The passage that we started with in 1 Corinthians 15, he says this, Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 15 verse 9. He says in this context about being such a hard worker, for I am the least of the apostles, unworthy to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. Here's one of the things that Paul never forgot. That I am not even worthy to be called an apostle. That I persecuted the church of God. Can you imagine Paul, after getting converted in Acts chapter 9, and then he stays in Damascus for some time. Remember, he has to get dropped out in a basket because there's going to be some people that were going to kill him. And then he goes to Jerusalem and he tries to join himself to the apostles, or to some of the Christians there. And then Barnabas has to kind of intercede for them. So now Paul is in Jerusalem where he was originally persecuting people. And now here he is preaching in synagogues, talking to other Christians. And I wonder if he would preach in different places and be able to look out at the audience and go, I killed your uncle. I had your sister killed. Like, would that have been something that was going on in Paul's mind wherever he was preaching in these areas that he persecuted? You know what he never forgot? Is that I was deep in sin. And as long as he never forgot that, he was somebody who was always going to appreciate God's grace. How do you think about yourself before you became a Christian? If you think about yourself, and if I think about myself as somebody who just needed like a minor tune-up, I just needed to learn how to stop doing a couple things, but generally I was a pretty good person. You realize that you're never going to appreciate God's grace. One of my favorite pictures of how dead we all were in the Bible is Ezekiel 37. This valley of dry bones, where Ezekiel gets 4 visions in the book of Ezekiel. This is the third one. Ezekiel gets taken into this valley of dry bones, and it says, and behold, the bones were very dry. Not just dry, they were very dry. Which means that if you stepped on them, they would like crunch under your feet. Sorry for the visual on that, but that's what it would have been like bones everywhere. And then God asks Ezekiel, hey, son of man, can these bones live? Now, if you're Ezekiel, and you know, God's speaking to you in this vision, and you see a bunch of really dry bones in this like valley of death, and God says, hey, can those bones live? If it was me, I was going, no, haven't you seen this? Like, there's no bone, or there's just all bone, no skin, no hearts, anything like that. It's all just bone. I'd say, no, God, that's a weird question. There's no way that this can live again. But Ezekiel, by faith, says, only you know, O Lord. And then he starts speaking. And then this life comes back to these bones and they get rejuvenated and restored. Do you realize that that's how dead you were? That you were just dry bones that couldn't save yourself. And apart from what Jesus came and coming down to us, We never could have gone up to him. We couldn't be good enough to do that. He had to come down to us. If I'm not humbly recognizing how much I need God's grace because of my sin, I will have an entitled demeanor towards God. Just think about some of these questions. How would I know if I'm humble? Here's a couple questions just to analyze our hearts that might help us know. Number one, how do I respond to criticism? If I'm really touchy every time somebody criticizes me, can I just translate that for a moment and say what that really means? If I'm really touchy with criticism, what that means is this. How dare you ever think that you could find something in my imperfect life that I might need to work on? Really? If you're really touchy all the time with criticism, could be an indication of a lack of humility. Number two, do I compare myself to people or to God? You think about those times in the Bible where people saw God or some kind of vision of God. Ezekiel chapter 1, you've got John in Revelation chapter 1, you've got Peter in Luke chapter 5 when Jesus catches all the fish. These times where people see the glory of God in some great way, and every time this happens in the Bible, people just go, oh wow, that was such a good experience. Every time they fall down like they're going to die. If I'm comparing myself to people, can I find people that I think I'm better than and feel pretty good about myself by doing that all the time? I'll actually enjoy finding problems with other people so I can feel better about myself. Pretty unloving. But that's pretty prideful. What if I compared myself to God? And I always realized, I've heard this illustration before. Imagine that there was somebody at the base of Mount Everest, and then there was somebody at the top of Mount Everest, and somebody asked the question, which one's closer to the moon? Does it matter at that distance? If we're comparing ourselves to God, we're going to see there's a great chasm. And that's our standard. Notice the next one. Do I seek help from others ever? If I'm never letting other people help me with my spiritual problems, with my physical problems, could be an indication of pride. Notice another one. Am I thankful to God? If I don't have an attitude of thankfulness, it's stemming from a lack of recognition at how much I've needed him to save me. Number five, am I working hard for the Lord? If I'm not working hard for the Lord, then it's an indicator that I am not thankful for what he's done for me. And Paul would say that I received God's grace and I worked really hard. So if I'm not working for the Lord, could be an indicator that I do not appreciate God's grace. I struggle with humility, things like that. All right, so that's the first thing, is to seek humility. Notice the last suggestion, though, is to preach to yourself. Martin Lloyd-Jones was a former physician who became a preacher. He was a Welsh preacher. I don't agree with some of what he taught about salvation and stuff like that. But he wrote a book called Spiritual Depression. It's causes and its cures or something like that. And he did a sermon on Psalm 42. One of his chapters is about Psalm 42. And he's got a really great quote that I just want to read part of this here. He says, have you realized that most of your unhappiness in life is due to the fact that you are listening to yourself instead of talking to yourself? Take those thoughts that come to you the moment you wake up in the morning. You have not originated them, but they start talking to you. They bring back the problems of yesterday. Do you know what that's like, by the way? I'm not done with the quote, but do you know what that's like? That you wake up in the morning and it's like your mind starts going here, there, yonder, worrying about this, worrying about that. And it's like you haven't even like told yourself to think about these things, but it just kind of instinctively happens. He goes on to say this. Who is talking to you? Yourself is talking to you. And then he goes on to start talking about the person in Psalm 42 and what he does about this kind of problem. He says, now this man's treatment was this. Instead of allowing this self to talk to him, he starts talking to himself. And this is what he says to himself in Psalm 42. Why art thou cast down, O my soul? He asks. His soul has been depressing him, crushing him. So he stands up and says, self, listen for a moment. I will speak to you. You must turn on yourself, upbraid yourself, condemn yourself, exhort yourself, and say to yourself, hope thou in God, instead of muttering in this depressed, unhappy way. And then you must go on to remind yourself of God, who God is, and what God is, and what God has done, and what God has pledged himself to do. You see what he's saying there? Do you think that's true, that a lot of our unhappiness in life, our lack of thankfulness, is stemming from just these muttering thoughts about what I think people might think about me, what's going on in the news right now? You're just kind of thinking these things all the time. He says what you need to do is you need to stop, and instead of just listening to yourself, you need to preach to yourself. Stop those thoughts and say to yourself, who is God? What has God done for me? What are the good deeds that he did when he was on this earth that I can try to replicate? We have to tell ourselves the promises that God has given to us, that he's never lied. It's impossible for him to lie. We have to think about the things that he says about us. We might worry about what people think about us, but we can know what God thinks about us. How often do we think about these things? One of my favorite things to do with new converts in Ephesians, the first three chapters of Ephesians, it lists out 12 different things that God calls us. And I have them all highlighted in my Bible in green. But here are the titles that God has given somebody who's a Christian. You're a saint, you're chosen, you're adopted, you're redeemed, you're forgiven, you're loved, you're alive, you're saved, you're God's workmanship, you're reconciled, you're a holy temple, and you're strengthened. That's just in the first three chapters of Ephesians. One of the things that Samantha and I have done whenever we've studied with people is we've sat down with them and said, highlight those things in the Bible. I almost dropped my Bible. Highlight those things in your Bible. Write those things on an index card and preach these things to yourself. Know that this is what God thinks about you. Instead of muttering all these things that cause us to be downcast and not thinking about God's grace in our life. How do you know if you're relying on God's grace and strength? You know if you're working tirelessly for the Lord. And it starts with what you're thinking. It starts with you and me stopping ourselves when we're thinking all kinds of things that are not directed towards the goodness of God. And when we can curb those thoughts and we can humble ourselves, I think it'll cause us to be more and more grateful and more zealously working for the Lord. I hope these thoughts have been helpful for us this morning. We're about to sing a song. Is the song number been chosen?
97 in the blue song.
Number 97. Okay, it's right there. Servant song. We're about to sing this song about being made into a servant. Do you want to be a servant? Is that something that you would like to get better at? The only way that we're going to get better at these things is knowing and appreciating that he did it for us first. If there's anything that we can do for you this morning, this is an opportunity for us to repent. This is an opportunity for us to humble ourselves. If there's something that you need to talk to somebody about here, don't leave here without talking to somebody, or you have the option of coming forward while we stand and while we sing.